Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review, we break down some of the biggest headlines from Tuesday's election, including what the voting trends could mean for both parties this fall. Plus, former President Donald Trump makes his return to the battleground state by holding a rally in Green Bay during the presidential primary. And U.S. Senate candidate Eric Hovde weighs in on some key topics shaping the race, including abortion and election laws. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for April 5th.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Well, we have quite a lot to get through this week, as there's plenty of post-election headlines. We're first going to start with kind of looking at the statewide referendums. Both of them that passed. Now, both of them dealt with some election issues, and they were authored by Republicans, and they were both approved by a majority of voters. The first question, of course, was related to banning private funding in elections. The second question, of course, was limiting conduct to certain election officials. This is a question that, you know, going forward, I think might need some more clarity of who it applies to. We talked about that last week. But as you can see, about 54% voted yes for the first question, 58% voted for the second question. No real surprise here, given just kind of when most statewide constitutions are on the ballot. Actually, when you look at the Legislative Fiscal Bureau, they did an analysis that over, since probably roughly about the 1850s, a majority of them do pass, despite some of them being a little controversial.
And you look at the overall turnout on Tuesday, you know, about 25% or so. But looking at the presidential primaries, a few more Republicans and Democrats. So that probably helped the yes people get that through. Republicans put a lot of effort into kind of making sure their voters knew the way they wanted to vote on that. And then two, there's some Democrats who support it as well, which is why you get the numbers that you did. I think there are fewer than 10 counties that voted no. So overall, wasn't a surprise, especially because the proponents got engaged and put some effort into making sure people knew how they felt about it.
Right, and it's definitely going to be something that we're going to be seeing a lot more. Of course, there's another statewide ballot referendum on the August ballot. There's another one going to be in November. And as we talked before, JR, this is an avenue that Republicans see that they can use, given that Governor Evers vetoed two very similar bills that addressed these issues. And they're going to be using this kind of a pathway going forward, as long as they control both chambers to get it before voters. Let's talk about another very controversial referendum that dealt with the biggest lump sum that was asked of voters, and we're talking about the Milwaukee school district referendum that was $252 million. Well, it did narrowly pass. Of course, we're going to get to, there was a kind of a shift in results very last minute, because there was about 150 absentee ballots that were counted into the night that shifted the results. But, you know, this was something that both sides of the issue were really passionate about. There was also a lot of money, nearly $500,000 invested in this, trying to oppose this referendum, but you know, in the end, it passed.
So a couple of things here. One, the opposition was from the Metro Milwaukee Association of Commerce Business Group. The face of that group was Dale Kienga, the president, former GOP state lawmaker. One thing I heard from people was that you are putting a suburban Republican former lawmaker as the face of an effort to convince voters in a majority minority city to vote against something. Maybe not the best messenger. It kind of underscores this feeling of, one, okay, now we're putting our partisan hats on, because Dale's a well-known Republican. So you've got a Republican saying vote no. Well, Democrats would flexibly like react against that. Well, why is he telling me what to do? And then two, a feeling of, you have suburban business folks who drive into Milwaukee, you know, to their places of work. They want city residents to vote no. Maybe not the best messenger. Maybe better to have a well-known city figure who could communicate, like, look, I live here. This affects me more than just this way, affects me personally, maybe a better way to do it. And then the targeting maybe wasn't the best. So it's like anytime you lose something, if you spend a lot of money, a lot of second guessing and finger pointing. And the kind of the reaction I got from folks this week was, it wasn't the best strategy to try and get people to vote no. And don't forget, there are what, like 5,000 employees of MPS? They're probably going to vote yes, because self-preservation, right?
Right, yeah.
That gives you a bank of votes right away. So there are a lot of factors like that that probably played into the final margin.
And a lot of those school board members and Milwaukee Superintendent Keith Posley held a press conference the day after, kind of talking about, you know, thanking voters, of course, for those who voted for it. But they also, once again, kind of reiterated what this funding is going to be needed for. Their big argument was that, hey, we can't keep up with inflation. And, hey, if lawmakers don't invest more in schools, we might likely keep seeing these referendums in the near future. I mean, it was only 4 years ago they asked for roughly a little bit more than $80 million from voters. Now it's jumping up to $252. I mean, it could be even much larger in the next few years. Let's just take a listen from Posley, too, in his message, talking about what some of these funds will be used for and kind of the challenges ahead.
It's just like the referendum question stated. Art, music, physical education, library and media specialists, smaller class size to retain highly qualified staff, counselors, social workers, and the list goes on. If funding does not change at the state level, districts will be in the same situation over and over. It's 91 districts went to referendum yesterday. 91. And then there will be others in November. So that lets you know right there, that's a funding flaw, and that has to be fixed. But the bottom line is that we have to do everything that we can to cut costs, and we're committed to doing just that.
Now we're going to take a little bit of deeper dive into where the votes were cast when it comes to this referendum. Now, John Johnson, he's a Marquette University researcher who does a lot of stuff on redistricting. We're going to take a look at this graphic, too, because his analysis showed how the city voted shows a majority of white wards, and those who have fewer children were more likely to have voted yes. Now, Johnson sorted through these election results by ward, and he found the results were slightly divided by race as well, as you can see, and even more noticeable difference is when you're looking at how many wards and households have children. Now, the wards where the referendum passed were mostly in the downtown area along the lakeside and near the west side, and most of the no votes were concentrated in wards on the city's northwest side and south side. But when you look at this, too, I think the big question is ahead is, you know, roughly about 50% of children go to MPS in the city of Milwaukee. So it's kind of difficult to say, was the yes votes driven by MPS parents? Was it driven by school choice parents? That's something I think we can't ever really get an analysis of, but that's kind of interesting going forward of how it got to it.
There's a sentiment that, oh, you know, white liberals drove the results. And yeah, you know, their white wards voted more favorably for the referendum than black ones did or Hispanic ones did. However, it wasn't like it was 60-40 yes in white wards and 60-40 no in black and Hispanic mm-hmm. wards. It was more like 53-47 in some of these black wards against it. So remember that. And two, there were a lot of people of color who voted for the referendum. It wasn't like it was overwhelmingly opposed in these neighborhoods. So there's that big thing taken away. But look, MPS, watching the opponents of the referendum react to what's happened, they're trying to draw this message, okay, they got an overwhelming vote 4 years ago for $87 million, whatever it was. This is a narrow vote by 1,700, I think, votes it was. This should tell MPS to change. I don't know that MPS is taking this as a being rebuked. But there is a question out there about, will the district right-size itself, both with its footprint and its staffing, because they are down 31.5% for students being educated at MPS compared to 20 years ago. So the question is, what's the path forward? What's the transparency going to be? I think the superintendent talked about we need to close some buildings and look at some stuff like that. But it is going to be maybe a tougher road to hoe for them going forward unless they take some actions that address these concerns.
Because that's what they wanted to do, right, when they were kind of advocating for this referendum. They said, we want smaller class sizes. And they did float the idea, like you said, closing some school district to consolidate. And once they do that, too, of course, you know, you can pay teachers maybe a little bit more, close some other schools down. And Posley did say at that press conference that is likely the plan coming forward. Now, let's move on to, of course, on election night, there is always room, I guess, for disgruntled voters. Mm-hmm. Voters who like to kind of spew some conspiracy theories if late night tallies happen. Of course, this possibly could have been addressed if there was the Monday processing bill that was went through the legislature, but it never reached the Senate, and that would allow clerks to process absentee ballots the day before an election. Well, since that wasn't in place, of course, there was kind of some skeptics out there that where did these 150 ballots come from? when the USPS dropped them off roughly around 7:15, 7:30 to Milwaukee Central Count. So this kind of, you know, got a lot of talk on Twitter and just voters. We got some calls in the newsroom because the MPS referendum was not on track to pass until those ballots came in. And that led to some to speculate the process. So what we want to just kind of tell people is kind of explain to them how this works. I spoke to Claire Woodall. She is the executive director of the Milwaukee Election Commission. She basically said that USPS has to drop off those ballots regardless. I mean, if you cast your ballot and it's postmarked before Election Day and it's sitting in a mailbox, they can still go collect those. It's still like if you're standing in line to vote, it's about 7:45. As long as you're in line by 8 p.m., your vote is still going to count. So there's no conspiracies out there. Just kind of wanted to talk through this, of how this actually works each day.
So worth noting, too, that the people who raise these theories focused on Milwaukee, nobody's really talking about Racine County, which had a little bit of a snafu with its posting of its results. Started putting stuff up on Tuesday night, pulled it back, and then didn't have results up, I think, until Wednesday afternoon. They had a reporting problem. Now, what I'm hoping, and I think everybody's hoping, is that come November, this is all figured out.
Because I think we all would like that, yes.
There's a county that has to pull back results on election night, November, at, you know, late at night. That's going to cause a lot of problems and a lot of nervous people during what's going on. But yes, so just keep that in mind, everybody.
Right. I mean, it's always not a great look, too. The Milwaukee County website also crashed. When there's, of course, a lot of people interested in seeing what the results are once polls close on Tuesday. So there's a few little things, tweaks that, of course, still need to be worked out. One thing I want to note, though, when I did talk to Claire Woodall, is I asked her, you know, what about that Monday processing bill? Do you think it would have made a difference? And what was a little surprising to me, even though there's a lot of clerks that testified to lawmakers, this would make a huge difference. She didn't really think so. Her view is that, listen, we are following all the state laws as possible that are on the books right now. We're not doing anything illegal. We're making sure every vote is cast. Would it make a huge difference? In her opinion, no. But like I said, we've heard from plenty of others who think it could make, you know, a difference to getting results in earlier. And of course, unfortunately, since Milwaukee is, you know, one of the largest cities in the state, they do receive some of the biggest criticisms, unfortunately. All right, now we're going to focus on some lawmakers who ran in some local races. We're going to highlight just a few of them here. Let's look at, of course, the ones that are on your screen with the green check mark. They are the ones that won. But unfortunately, one that was defeated was Representative Todd Novak. He, for a very long time, was the Dodgeville mayor race, and he lost that. But looking at Representative Evan Goyke, he won the Milwaukee City Attorney's Office against Tierman Spencer, who had quite a lot of controversial things that happened in his office. A lot of staff left, so he had a few problems, I guess you can say. Representative Cabrera won a seat on the Milwaukee County Circuit Court judge, and then Representative Steve Doyle secured his seat on the La Crosse County Board.
So looking at them one by one, first with Evan. So Tierman's got his problems, a number of them. So for Evan, the margin wasn't a surprise, I think 62-36. The insiders, Tierman's problems allowed Evan to focus on Evan's good things, let Tierman's own worst enemy, and that's part of why he won. Marissa Bell, interesting looking at the finance reports. She put about $62,000 of her own money into the race, $68,000 I think overall raised to the pre-election period. Her opponent only had like $8,500 raised, so Marissa Bell did two mailers, what I could tell from that report, versus a digital buy by her opponent. Still surprising the narrow margin for a sitting lawmaker running against an attorney, but if you're talking about a countywide race, you know, TV helps a little bit to get up on the air. A little more money would have helped, so that might have played a role in it. With Doyle, what's interesting is his assembly seat got more Republican in this last redistricting process, the new maps. So if he had lost that seat for the county board, you'd have heard a bunch of Republicans saying, hey, this guy's got problems for this fall, even though it's a very different electorate in November versus April. That said, got 58.5% of the vote, by the way, been on the board since 1986. Did not know that either until this week. Todd Novak, I talked to him about his loss in that mayor's race, said that he saw it coming, essentially. So, one, he says he loses the city of Dodgeville often in his assembly races. It's got a Democratic lean to it. I went back and looked, and sure enough, last time he won his assembly seat but lost the city. Two, he said, look, people want to change. I've been mayor for 10 years. They're looking for something different. Also found out something new this week. If you are a smaller community, you can avoid having a spring primary for your local race and put everybody in the ballot in April. So there's a three-person runoff there for mayor in April. Todd finished a distant second. Now, His seat goes from about 54% Republican from the 22 maps to 55% Democratic in the new maps. So Dodgeville's not his only worry, but he's still going to run this fall. I think my favorite result, lawmaker this week, was Angie Sapik, a freshman from up north. She won two seats in the Douglas County Board. So the backstory is there were four seats on the board where nobody registered to run. They're all vacant. She mounted a write-in campaign kind of late for the one where she lives. Well, as word got out, her supporters in a different district wrote her name in as well. Now, she won the first one where she lives, and she served like with 78 votes. The second one, she won with 5 votes. That's all it took to win a county board seat. She can't serve there because she doesn't live there. But now the question is, okay, what happens to that seat? The county clerk said, look, I'm asking Elections Commission, what do I do?
Right.
The second place finisher who had 2 votes, does that person get the seat? Does it go back? Is it vacant, essentially? We have to appoint somebody. So, yeah, just an interesting story all around. By the way, Sapik, her assembly seat goes from a swing one to a 50-some percent Dem seat. She's not going to run for the assembly again this fall. Says it's not really, there's no point to it. So, but she'll be on the county board going forward.
I mean, kudos to her. I mean, right? I don't think I've ever heard of that happening before. So good for her. All right. Now we're going to go looking at the presidential primary. Of course, with former President Donald Trump winning and Joe Biden winning, that's not really the headlines we want to talk about here. Of course, we're going to throw up the results. Some of the key takeaways, though, JR, is that the tens of thousands of votes that Biden and Trump lost on Tuesday night. So when you're looking at this, of course, the factor for warning sign, I would say, for Republicans and the Trump campaign is that even though every single one of his opponents have dropped out of the race, U.N. Ambassador, former U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley received nearly 13% of the vote. That's more than 76,000 votes. On the other side, kind of the worry signs for the Biden campaign is the uninstructed movement. I mean, we've talked about this before, that they had a vote threshold of roughly about 20,000. And that, of course, was comparing back to 4 years ago. And that was the margin that Biden defeated Trump by, roughly a little bit more than 21,000. Well, they nearly doubled that. They were close to receiving 50,000 votes across the state. And of course, the uninstructed movement is a protest vote and those who do not appreciate Joe Biden's handling of the ongoing war in Gaza. So those were kind of the big headlines. But while April elections are not really big, you know, indicators of what's going to come fall, there's definitely some voting trends like this that we can take a look at. Now, I spoke to both state party chairs about this. You know, what are your concerns about these tens of thousand votes that are not going towards your leading candidate? And here's what they both had to say.
Of course, we want to reach out and get folks who maybe voted that way or had intended to vote that way had there been an active primary. But so that's a project, right? But it does not, it's not a situation where I'm going, oh, we'll never get those people back, because all the polling you see not only in Wisconsin but nationally shows those people will come back.
It's very different to cast a protest vote about a policy right now than it is to say that there's no way you'll ever support someone. I think the opportunity here is to make sure that people are heard, that we are connecting with them and making the case, and also seeing change actually happen on the ground in the Middle East. And if all those things come together, I think we have a chance for a real historic victory this November.
So I think the bottom line here, JR, is that both parties have some work to do here in Wisconsin still come November.
And talking to insiders on both sides, they are fairly confident that their votes will come home come November. They're just not sure if all of them will come home. So with the, let's start with the Democrats, uninstructed, okay. Biden got a higher percentage of the vote than Trump did, you know, 88%, something like that. But he won by 20,000 votes 4 years ago. Anything that cracks that coalition is a problem for him. But when those voters have a choice come November, are they going to vote against Biden, like vote for somebody else, stay home when Trump is the alternative? That's the question. Likewise for Republicans, yeah, Trump was below 80%. That's not great when you are an incumbent president, or sorry, a person who was president before running as your party standard bearer, having secured the nomination. That's not a great look. But will they all come home? How does Joe Biden attract Nikki Haley voters who are Republicans? Like, these aren't, you know, casual Republicans. People who turn out in a primary in April and the race is over. Like, right. They're there to send a message. Okay. Now, also in the presidential race, Noble Labels this week had turned in enough signatures, as long as they were verified, to get on the ballot in Wisconsin this November. Dropped the effort, said basically we can't find somebody who can win. so we're going to drop it. Well, that's a relief for Joe Biden because there's a feeling like that would hurt him more than anybody else. Also this week, Wall Street Journal poll, if it's a head-to-head matchup, and this is a poll, snapshot time, they change, but it had Trump and Biden even among registered voters, but Biden up a little bit, ever so slightly with likely voters. But you go to a five-person race with Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Cornel West, and Jill Stein, then Trump's up by 3 points. Now I say up, but it's in the margin of error, so take it with a grain of salt. My illustration, though, is that Biden may have gotten a better share of the Democratic vote in this primary, but he's got potential to lose more with multiple candidates in the race come November. Again, good news from No Labels is not going to be in the ballot, but maybe a problem with RFK, Jill Stein, Cornel West.
And speaking of former President Donald Trump, he held a rally in Green Bay. And some of the highlights, of course, were him hammering Biden once again on immigration issues. And he also repeated some false claims that the election was stolen. Before we kind of dive more deep into some of the policy items that he talked about, let's just take a listen from a clip from his rally.
You know, we won this state. We won this state by a lot. And it came out that we won this state, actually. Joe Biden is so weak on the border that other countries are now publicly taunting and extorting him by pumping migrants across our wide open border. They're opening their jails and they're opening their mental institutions and they're bringing them right in and nobody stops them. Nobody has any idea what's going on.
Of course, a key central theme of Trump's reelection campaign is immigration and the border. He talked about, I want to say, the most. I was there at the rally. That was the big leading topic, of course, tying that to crime, et cetera. You know, repeating the false claims about the 2020 election, talking to some Republican insiders. They're just, you know, he's going to say what he wants to say. But then you have, you know, the chairman of the state Republican Party, Brian Schimming, and you have some RNC folks who are trying to really move away from that rhetoric and push early voting. We once again heard people like U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, who was on stage before Trump, saying, hey, we really have to embrace this, guys. We can't be down tens of thousands of votes and, you know, try to compete with Democrats. Also, they made the snowstorm that I thought was a little bit worse than Green Bay, but I saw it was pretty nasty here in Madison as well, as a prime example. You know, they're trying to tell people, look, things can happen. Your car can maybe, you know, not start or unfortunately veer off of the road. I mean, you don't want to, you know, say crazy things, but things can happen and things can deter you from going to the polls given the weather. So I think that is still going to be a challenge going forward with Republicans, you know, trying to convince people, hey, you should really do this. But on the other hand, you're hearing from the top dog, the former president, saying, don't trust it, don't do it. He also said that he believes that voting should be held on one day and one day only by paper ballot. I mean, he's repeated that before, but it just shows kind of the constant struggle of the Republican base trying to unify.
Yeah, there's no question why he's stressing immigration. Poll after poll shows he's got an edge over Biden, significant one on that issue. Also came out from his rallies on Tuesday in Grand Rapids in Green Bay that he didn't quite tell the truth about talking to the family of a victim who was killed by an illegal immigrant or documented person. So that's kind of an interesting development as well. But yeah, I mean, Trump's going to hammer this over and over again. It was the main issue, one of the main issues of 2016. Mm-hmm. It hasn't changed.
Right. And looking ahead to Monday, President Joe Biden is going to be back to the Badger State. He's going to be holding an event in Madison. Don't have the details quite yet, but once again, just showing how both campaigns are paying real close attention to this crucial swing state. Also want to mention some other election news with the 8th Congressional District. We now have our first Democrat who has announced a bid, JR.
Kristen Lierley, OBGYN. She was one of the interveners, I should say, in the lawsuit seeking to overturn the 1849 law, which had been interpreted to ban all abortions in Wisconsin to save the life of the mother. She formally announced this week, also announced she raised $125,000 in the first 24 hours of her campaign. Look, her and Peter Barkas talked about running for Congress now in the 1st Congressional District. They may not win, but they give Democrats, if Barkas gets in, very credible candidates in seats where there's this theory among Dems of we can actually help the bottom up. Usually the president race drives everything.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
But with Biden maybe not so strong among some Democrats, that every bit could help. Having a stronger candidate in the 1st Congressional District, if Barkas gets in, could be help. Having Kristen up in the 8th Congressional District, especially when Democrats didn't run somebody against Gallagher 2 years
yeah.
ago,
mm-hmm.
that could help. Every 1,000 votes helps in a state like Wisconsin. That might be part of the strategy is, yeah, if we catch lightning strikes, you can win. But if we don't, we have this person to kind of help go talk to people and gin up enthusiasm.
All right. Now let's get to stock picks this week. And rising this week is Governor Evers for a variety of vetoes that he's issued, actually the most in history.
The Evers vetoes, yes. I think he's got 188 or 189 as of right now. The previous record holder was 167. Governor served back in the 1920s. Interesting note, if you're a dork like me about Wisconsin politics, he had a massive supermajority of Republicans. Republican governor, huge supermajority of Republicans, but back then there wasn't really a Democratic Party in Wisconsin, and the progressives hadn't split off. So it was like 27-4, I think, for Republicans in the Senate, some crazy number like that. But anyway, Evers has had a Republican legislature and the whole time. So it's a different dynamic than 80, 90 years ago. But he has been the hockey goalie against Republican initiatives, which is why you're seeing government by constitutional referendum, constitutional amendment. Republicans can't get things past Evers. They're going to referendum. They haven't overridden any of his vetoes. So that's been a challenge for them. So this is where they go. Now, the question is, will any veto come back to hurt Democrats this fall? One veto was about a tax break. One veto was the transgender athlete bill. Like, are these things going to be big issues this fall? I don't know, in part because presidential races tend to nationalize everything and push out whatever message you want. Now, they'll be in mail pieces, but it's going to be hard to see if, like, the tax breaks he vetoed come back to bite Democrats this fall in such a nationalized environment.
Right. I mean, you know, you do hear Trump talk about, you know, we're going to give you guys tax cuts if I'm reelected. He also mentioned, too, about LGBT issues. So, I mean, does that really resonate with everyone? I mean, you make a good point. We'll see if that's what people go to the voter or the ballot box with. Now, let's get to Mix this week as U.S. Senate candidate Eric Hovde, who is competing with Senator Tammy Baldwin. He held his first public, you know, press conference with a lot of news outlets yesterday. Kind of said a lot of statements on specifically his views on abortion and the election, and it comes on the heels of him receiving Donald Trump's endorsement. And what I think was most interesting, as we've seen a little bit more Republicans try to do this, try to distance himself from the former president, specifically that Hovde doesn't believe the 2020 election was stolen. Does he believe there were issues? Yes. But he doesn't want to go that lane, doesn't want to relitigate 2020. He wants to focus on, you know, this year on abortion issue. It was in 2012, the last time he was on the ballot. He was totally opposed to abortion, and now he has kind of dramatically changed his views on that and when it comes to, you know, fertilization treatments, birth control, et cetera.
So he has a Trump endorsement. Now he has to deal with the Trump endorsement. So by that I mean the Trump endorsement probably helps in western Wisconsin and northern Wisconsin. You know, those are really Trumpy places. Hub needs to do well in the suburban areas, especially around Milwaukee. Does it help him in suburban Milwaukee? Probably not. So it might be a net neutral, but he's going to have to do that dance with Trump that Republicans tend to do, where Trump has, it seems like, a ceiling right now. So now if Trump wins 52% of the vote in November, different dynamic. But if he's where we've seen him before, where he got 47% in 2016, 48-ish or 49 in 2020, he doesn't have coattails to get you above 50%. You have to outrun Donald Trump. How does Eric Hovde do that? We're seeing signs of it with what he talked about that news conference, telling reporters about his position on abortion or about the elections, trying to kind of create a little bit of distance. He's trying to say, I'm not going to engage in the politics of personal destruction, trying to be that kind of positive, happy warrior type thing. At the same time, the Trump base doesn't want a positive, happy warrior. They want somebody who's a, you know, bare-knuckle brawler. Like, that's what Trump is kind of like ingrained in the base. So does Hovde excite those folks? Oh, by the way, I haven't heard the anti-abortion groups yet really embrace Eric Hovde's position on abortion right now. They may not be thrilled or excited about it because of where he's at. But it's that dance you do as a candidate sometimes, especially with Trump on the ballot.
And we got a little bit left falling this week is Katie Rosenberg. She lost a Wausau mayor race after being kind of a rising star when she won in the first place.
She won an upset in 2020, probably helped by the presidential ballot primary turnout that year. Kind of really got her brand was holy balls as her tweet after she found out she was going to win. She governed as, you know, a liberal in this kind of red sea up there, and she was seen as a rising star who could maybe be a toehold for Democrats up there in that Wausau area because it's gotten trended way worse for them over the years. But these races are intensely local. There are PFAS up in the water in Wausau. Utility bills went up to try and address that. Doug Denny, a retired sales executive, ran against her. Focused on those rising bills, what he called shady politics in City Hall. and Republicans quietly lined up money behind him. And then you saw like this effort by outside groups to do mail, calling her reckless Rosenberg and crazy Katie and stuff like that. The Democratic Party of Wisconsin came in late with a $109,000 TV buy, but they felt like she didn't really realize what was going on and the challenge in front of her and reacted too late, wasn't doing the things you need to do to win a local race. Now, Republicans are saying, hey, this is a big deal for November because Biden won that city by 8 points. She lost by like four. Electors are much different November versus April. So 10,000 people voted for mayor this week. 19,000 voted for president in 2020. Different electorate. Unless you can make Wausau's water bills the problems of President Biden, I don't know if it's going to make a big difference. But what it does do, though, is for Rosenberg, there's an assembly seat now that's focused on the city of Wausau and Weston. It's still Republican-leaning, but it's a kind of seat in the right environment with the right popular local official. You could win that seat. This throws cold water in the idea that she could be that candidate, at least now, to win that seat in the assembly.
All right. Well, that will do it for this week. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
We'll see you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind. Your Week in Review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.